Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Trail Culture. I'm your host, Em Robertson, and I'm so stoked that you're tuning in. Today is going to be part one of a two-part episode with James Montgomery from The Run Project. We are going to be talking about the craft of coaching, how to work with a developing athlete, and what makes a great coach. I am super excited about this chat, and as you all know, season two of Trail Culture is fueled by Carbon Endurance. They are an endurance sport consulting company. They really have you covered in terms of fuel and hydration for all of your performance needs. It's really amazing to be able to work with a team who understand athletes, understand the trail space, and are just working together to ensure that athletes can have their best training and racing performances possible. Really excited about that partnership. Go and check them out. The details are in the show notes. I hope that you guys enjoy part one of this two-part episode, and I'll see you back here next week for the next one. Guys, welcome back. Another episode of Trail Culture. We are back with season two. I hope you guys have been enjoying listening to the new round of episodes that have been released. And this week, I'm stoked to welcome a great coach and athlete all the way from just outside of Chamonix, James Montgomery, affectionately known by many people as Monty. And James is the founder and a head coach at The Run Project alongside his partner, Meg McKenzie, also a great athlete, incredible coach, previous guest on the podcast. He works with many people and a lot of South Africa's best athletes. And I think his attention to detail sets him apart as a coach and a human. So yeah, very stoked to have you on the podcast today, James. Welcome all the way from the other side of the pond.
Thank you very much for having me. And there are definitely a number of titles in there that I don't deserve, or I definitely wouldn't call myself an athlete. I think Meg is a great athlete, but I'm very much a plodder. And but yeah, love it. And yeah, thank you for having me. And I've listened to a good number of your podcasts with a lot of the. It's actually quite an interesting way of getting an insight into the athletes. Some stuff that they awesome. May not tell me, and then yes. I listen, and I'm like, oh, that's interesting, or it's fascinating to get their opinion on something. Yeah. So
a couple of your athletes. Yeah, thanks, James. That's awesome. And yeah, we've had a good number. I think Daniel gave us a super interesting insight, I think, into like the pain cave and racing and where he goes. And B was just like an incredible episode to record as well. So, oh, and obviously Johart was our first episode ever. So almost a year ago, which is epic.
Yeah. In fact, Johart's the one actually who probably eventually convinced me to come on, because he kind of said to me, and I always say, like, what am I going to say? what knowledge do I have or anything like that that's going to be of any value to anyone? But Yart was actually the one who said to me, you'd be a good person to chat to, and
epic.
You'll be okay if I have strong opinions on things. So
I'll be fine, the audience will also be fine, and you have lots that I want to chat to you about, Monty. I think your name's come up. I've like interviewed a couple of your athletes, but also people who've worked with you, and like from kind of the coaching side of things as well. I like want to say, like, I respect your work. Whenever you post something, that's, I'm like, this is going to be worth reading, like, before I even get into it.
I always struggle with those.
No, I'm like, go for it. The blog post, the Instagram, I'm there for it. Something with a bit more substance to it than just flash. So no, it's awesome. And Monty, we usually start off these things like with the human. It's always nice to get to know the person. So, and this is going to be cool for me as well, because I don't know you super well, other than the fact that we lived on the same stretch of road for maybe a couple of weeks. but to start off, where did it all start? How did you find yourself in the sport and running space?
So I've been passionate about sports as long as I can remember. Not always running. First, I guess, like a lot of South African kids, rugby and cricket were my first passions. Although I do remember watching Comrades when I was probably 5 or 6 years old, for the first time, and being quite blown away by Bruce Fordyce in particular, and then I guess like I was always more interested in like sprinting than because of rugby. Like rugby for me was like the main sport, and So I always did athletics, and I'll never forget, I think the first time I ran a 5K, probably, I don't know, 10 years old, and I was naturally quite fit from all the sport that I played, and it went like really well. And had two schoolmates who were good athletes. One actually went on to be a really top triathlete. Anyway, and I was third. I'll never forget that. And I thought, this is so easy, you know, like it's not hard at all. And then the next year, then I might have actually been at 3K. And then the next year, I think we stepped up to 5K. And I remember my dad was running, and I was ahead of him with like a K and a half to go.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, stopped next to the side of the road, and I just threw up. And I threw up and I threw up. And he eventually came past me. And I think like little of the competitor was like, actually, stop. I'm not waiting. I'm going to just run. And I don't think I ran probably further than a few hundred meters for a good number of years after that.
My word.
And then I was in standard nine, so grade 11. For some bizarre reason, when our preseason for rugby, this shows you how far back this was. Our preseason for rugby was to run 100 Ks over the month or over your December holidays, right?
Oh,
And
wow.
so anyway, I kind of got stuck into doing that, and then I went to New Zealand on exchange and did a bit of running there because we had like quite a big golf course on at the school premises. And I just really love running around the golf course. I just find it super fun. And then the following year, I decided to jump into an 800,
Oh.
and absolutely fell in love with it. Had no idea how to train. Again, my training was like I'd run 2.5 Ks to the gym and 2.5 Ks back. And I did that every day.
Yes.
And then yeah, I jumped into 800 and was okay. I mean, I was no near the level of the guys that I coach now, but I was okay. And we had a big, I went to Wynberg, and our triangler for our sins was with Paul Boys and Paul Roos.
Ah,
And
oh, brutal.
you just like they were just so athletically gifted. And I remember even at the time, obviously having played rugby against those guys, it's like always been fascinated in movement and like athleticism. Like that for me has always been like I guess captivating. I remember lining up these guys and just thinking like I feel like I'm not the same level. You know what I mean? I don't have the
Yeah.
same genetics. I don't have the same physiology. But anyway, did it and absolutely loved it. And then kind of after that, that was kind of like I guess my reintroduction to running again, sort of longer distances, even though for a while it wasn't too much longer. And then in my varsity days, I started doing a little bit more running, and a friend of mine took me onto the mountain. He was actually a South African guy, but had lived in Switzerland and done a lot of orienteering. And he took me up. So I ran for VOB, and we went up the old, like the jeep track to the top of the dams. And I remember just being like, "This is absolutely amazing. Like, this
Yeah.
is what I've been looking for." And yeah, after that, I just fell in love with it and did some road running for a few years, and then did some more trail running. And yeah, I guess over time, just got super passionate about it, interested. And then I got two pretty serious injuries. I got shattered a bone in my heel,
Oh.
and then I got compartment syndrome. And I basically missed, I don't know, 5 or 6 years of running in my 20s. And I guess
Wow.
that sort of got me fascinated in understanding movements. Number one, like why had I suddenly got a non-contact injury? I've never had one in my life. Then I got two. And then I guess slowly coming to grips with that, I saw Mike Watson, who is a strength coach in Cape Town, and is a little bit of an enigma, but a huge mentor. In fact, one of the people that's been the most influential in my life. And then slowly got into understanding, I guess, the training side of things a little bit better, and made every mistake under the sun, as you do. You know, you read one book
Yeah.
and you think that's the answer to everything. And then you read another book,
Yes.
and then you're a little bit
You
confused.
change it.
And
Yeah.
you read a third book, and you're even more confused. And you've changed
Yeah.
three times. So, yeah, I guess that's kind of how I got into it. And I guess soon realized where my limitations were. But in a way, never let that sort of detract from my love for it and my
Yeah.
love for
Yeah.
firstly trying to get myself a little bit fitter.
Yeah.
And then yeah, I started out actually coaching friends. I lived in London for 5 years and I came back. I was 28, and a lot of my friends were a little bit overweight and unfit. And at Wynberg, there was a obviously a number of sports fields, but they'd built like an obstacle course.
Yeah.
And so I'd read this this book and spoken about like this natural method of getting fit, and it combined like natural movements and running. I was like, oh, this is such a smart way of getting people fit without with needing minimal equipment. And we used
Yeah.
to go on a Tuesday and Thursday morning before work, and it just grew and grew, and eventually I had like 20 people that would come.
Unreal.
I would take the session, I'd do it, but we'd take the session, and yeah, just basically we did that for a couple of years, and I guess that was probably the formal introduction to coaching.
Yo, that's so cool. Oh my word. I love that your injury didn't deter you from running. You kind of kept coming back. There is something about the sport that does that to you. But I also dig the mistakes thing. It's like Reed's born to run, throws shoes out of the window and goes, "This is my life now." And then you're like Reed shoe dog and then change your mind again. And that's awesome. And I mean, Monty, you mentioned now like you've moved around, you've done a few things, but something I didn't know, and this is like one of my favorite things about podcasting, it's like people have a perception and they're like, "Yo, this person is a full-time athlete or full-time X, Y, and Z." And then it's like, I found out that you were an investment analyst for a long time and you've got lots of experience there. And I assume that was the London kind of stint that you did doing that. So how does one find themselves going from being an investment analyst and jumping into starting something like the Run Project, which is James and Meg's awesome coaching business?
So as I said, it kind of started with coaching our friends and coaching in inverted commas. And then a few of them said to me, like, look, would I actually coach them? You kind of do that for free for a good few years. You learn and you make mistakes. And then actually met Meg, I'll say like 2017, something like a training for Otter. Actually, Kerri-Ann Marshall was my physio at the time.
No
And
way.
here we had organized to do a run, an Otter training run together, and Meg came along, and I designed the routes that we were going to do, and like to try and make it as specific as possible for Otter, and so that's when Meg and I met, and we just really struck off a really good friendship. And it took a little bit of time, I guess. Like, she was coaching some people and I was sort of coaching some people. And she one day kind of came up with ideas like, look, let's start something. And I really thought at the beginning it would just continue to be like a passion project. It's just do something on the side. I was interested in helping people. I'd love sport. Like, I guess the other thing is I'd always, as my holiday jobs, I'd always coach sports. So
Yes.
cricket and rugby as throughout, like, in fact, I think the earliest I coached was when I was 13. I remember coaching like the Pee Wee rugby players, and then like throughout university I'd coach, and I absolutely loved it. So I guess I always had that like part of me. And then yeah, I always thought I had a good job in finance. I was interested in what I did. I enjoyed it. And I remember we decided to do, so we had started the Run Project pretty informally. So probably almost 8 years ago now, I think. And we decided to go up to Durban and to do like a series of like workshops or talks or whatever. And we kind of came back from that, and the amount of interest that we generated and the number of people that then subsequently joined meant that I actually was really struggling to combine work and coaching.
Yeah.
So I was at a point where like I'd have to come home from a full day of like finance work and then coach and then the same thing on the weekends, and just actually was getting to a point where it was not sustainable. And I'll never forget, I was walking around the Woolworths and Dean Streets, and I was talking on the phone to Meg, and she said something on the lines of like, well, if you're at this point, like, when will you quit finance? And I was like, I'll quit finance when we're coaching 100 people. And she's like, then she
Wow.
said to me, do you think they will get to 100 people? And I probably at the time were at 60 or 70 already. And she's like, do you think we'll get there? And I said, yes. And then she's like, well, why didn't you quit? And I was like, not really the way I like to think about things, but
Yeah.
yeah, I guess it's a fair point. And a couple of days later, I went in to speak to my boss. He's a German guy, and I always thought like he's going to take this so badly. And I remember him listening to everything I had to say, and then at the end of it just saying, if I was in your shoes, I'd do the exact same thing. And
Wow.
so, and then came back to me a day later to say, look, would I consult? So when I was researching companies in the stock exchange, one of the sectors that I did was the insurers, and no one
Okay.
likes to cover
Yes.
insurers. They're complex and not overly sexy to cover.
Yeah.
And he said, would I do that? And I said, yeah, actually, it's perfect. It's a great way to transition. So I did that for a year. And that was in 2019, was the first time I quit. And then I quit again at the beginning of 2020, and I was going to go do some traveling. And then obviously COVID hit. And in fact, my first day of my second time quitting was the first day of lockdown,
Oh my
which was
word.
quite funny because I guess, and I was like, oh, maybe I should stay. But anyway, I didn't and decided to kind of run with it and see where things would end up. And that was kind of I guess the full-time move to run project, but previously it was obviously still occupying a lot of my time.
That is insane. I'm like, well, yeah, taking the leap. I feel like also that was before. I mean, what year was this, James?
So 2019 is the first time I quit work.
Okay.
So probably like in 2020 is the second time I quit.
Okay.
So when Meg probably convinced me the first time was probably the end of 2018.
Okay. Yeah, and that's like just before it boomed, trail running, I think. So it's like people were coaching and trying to figure it out, but at least within the context of South Africa, to tell someone like I'm a trail running coach, like that wasn't a career yet,
No,
I want to say.
no. I
Like
mean, I remember
I'm
telling my mother, and she almost fell off her chair. She was like, how can
Yeah.
you give up like the career that you've got?
Yes. The
And
security. Yeah.
all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And I
Yeah.
have to give huge amounts of credit to Meg because
Yeah. A legend.
ultimately, number one, without her name, there was, maybe we would have gotten there in the end, but it would have taken a lot longer. And secondly, as you said, the luck, timing, randomness of life that you happen to start this at a time when the sport is hugely growing. And I think that's a massively valuable lesson. It's, in fact, that in and of itself, there's a book I read, it's called Fooled by Randomness. It's a guy called Nassim Taleb who wrote it. And he has a series of, let's say books, but it's essentially a series of lectures on life. And he wrote that book, I don't know if you've ever heard of The Black Swan, but
Yes.
essentially, Fooled by Randomness is probably like Mike Watson. A point in my life where you meet someone or read something that really changes the way you view the world. And Fooled by Randomness is a lot about understanding the role that luck, randomness, timing, all these things have in success and failures in life. And being able to step back and be mindful of those things. And I'm very conscious that a large part of our success, for want of a better term, came down to number one, Meg, and number two, luck and timing.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe that's how it started, and we're going to get into more of your kind of coaching as a craft now, but like how you've built and how you've done things since then is like really also one of the reasons why you're here today, is to like talk to us about that. Because I think now we're in a phase and where if you kick a bush in Cape Town, a running coach will fall out of it. And it's that's
I like that. I might use
and that's not
that.
it can be a great thing. I don't think it's a great thing yet. And we're gonna get more into that just now. But for the sake of the community, I'm glad that the Black Swan anomaly of James and Meg starting Run Project occurred. That is wonderful. James, just to frame a little bit more of, so I mean, you guys went on a tour to Durban. You were here in South Africa. You've moved. Earlier on this year, I had the incredible privilege of meeting the Live to Run guys, and then Dee, and like love had followed like their work for a while. I've got a couple of friends who are at the village this year, and like I'd heard and seen the talent coming through there. And I think I kind of knew that you were involved, but chat to us a little bit about like how that relationship came about. Was that like when you were in KZN? And just for those who don't know, like cross-country culture in South Africa is very strong. It's huge. I think it's the lesser known thing. Kane had like really cool insights on it, and specifically in KZN, like it's massive. So yeah, tell us a little bit about that.
So I think you mentioned Kane, and Kane is the was the driving force for my involvement with Live. And so he certainly deserves all the credit for that. And then obviously, as you said, like Lindy, I mean, Lindy's dedicated her life to that, right? And I
Yeah.
think it's so easy to kind of post on social media what you're doing for the community. But I think it's astounding to me the amount she has contributed
Yeah.
to live. Not only was she the founder or is the founder, but just the continual work that she puts into that.
Yeah, someone has
And
to
obviously,
actually put in the work, and that's her. Yeah,
yeah.
it's next
And I
level.
think what people underestimate is not just getting like organizing race entries and equipment. Like, this is mentorship at grassroots level. This
Yeah.
is taking guys with absolutely nothing, absolutely zero, no career, no opportunities. And yeah, the amount of work that she does is absolutely, yeah, it blows my mind. And how much she's dedicated to that project. So Kane reached out to me. Meg had done some stuff for Liv while she was a Salomon athlete. Obviously, Kane was previously working with Salomon, and he had direct involvement with Liv, and sort of just mentioned it to me, and we kind of brainstormed an idea where initially I would mentor one of their athletes to become a coach. And I guess through a number of different circumstances, that's not how things have transpired at present. And I think I'm glad for that, because it's meant that I've been able to have a continued role there. And it's I guess it's less about having athletes that are elite, and it's more about a holistic view to providing a platform and opportunity for young people to, number one, experience a sport that they otherwise never would,
Yeah.
experience races that they otherwise never would. But then also to, you mentioned the role of cross country in the KZN community is massive, right? And I mean, it's always funny every time they send me the KZN cross country league events. I'm like absolutely blown away that there's that many. Like, how there's that many races? I'm used to like Western Cape, where there's like five or something. So anyway, like, it's for these guys to be able to work and coach and mentor in their communities, and to grow the sports of trail running beyond themselves, right? Because, I think my belief is that unless you can see an opportunity yourself, like it's they're almost close enough for you to grab it. It's not possible for you to believe in it enough, if you haven't, to then mentor and coach people around you, right?
Yeah, yo.
And so these guys are now experiencing these races, and even if their destiny is not to be the best and to race overseas, whatever, they're close enough that they can see, actually, if we take the tools that we now have, let's mentor the next generation of guys, let's show them there's a sport of trail running, and what is required to succeed, and let them be the next generation of coaches and mentors in their communities. And that's ultimately the beauty of Live to Run. It's not
Yeah.
selecting the best runners and sending them to races and kind of hoping for the best.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a place for that, but it's not what Live to Run is.
Yeah.
And then I was very lucky in that there's another incredible human being, John Cornfield, who works for RMB. And I know John from my finance days. And I kind of pitched the idea to him about RMB and FirstRand getting involved. And he was a massive driving force behind that, just absolutely passionate about the sports, and passionate about growing opportunities for young people. And I think without Lindy and without John, the Live to Run success story is not there. And Yeah, those are the two people to really celebrate with.
Yeah. And it's amazing for me, like part of her interview at Mutt and telling us about Liv and just like the structures that are in place. And it's like, again, it's not a like a flash in the pan thing. This is like years and years. And like the point of also everything that they're investing now is that it lasts like way beyond their involvement, which is so cool. And seeing like chatting to a couple of the guys and like really seeing them be like stoked about running, but then also like the principles that running teaches you for your life, and whether it's business or family or whatever. There's like such a close parallel there, and like seeing that go down, and then watching them the next day actually race and like really put out like these incredible efforts and like give the others a run for their money. There's just this beautiful like cool stoke that comes together. I was like, this is such a great initiative. So yeah, Lindy, I mean, I'll stick all of that in the show notes again. I think we love Live to Run, and I'm excited already to chat to the team again at Otter. It seems like they're going to be
Yeah.
making an appearance, which will be cool. But yeah, super interesting to hear your involvement, James. And they did complain a lot about the hard sessions you give them. I was laughing. They're
Well,
like
you know what's quite amazing is obviously like through a lack of access to, you know, like I always look at Kane or Daniel, these guys, you know, they can if they want to run in the mountain every day of the week, and you know, we're trying to increase the amount of exposure that the live guys can get to trails.
Yeah.
But the reality is, like, you know, outside of the training camps that we do, certainly preparing for Otter, they've got to go to the stairs in Palito, and
Yeah.
you know, like, always think, like, the sessions that I give those guys, there are very few other people that would consistently do them, and that's amazing.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, I'm sure you know this about me, like, I'm the last person to give something to someone because it's hard. Like, I try to give people what I think they need,
Yes.
and I guess I'm more interested in seeing how little someone can do than how much they can do. Like, you know,
Yeah.
how can you get someone to succeed using the minimum effective dose as opposed to the maximum? But I guess with a lot of the training that they have to do, a lot of it has to be quite manufactured,
Yeah.
and I mean, it's remarkable. Like, it is
Yeah.
absolutely remarkable, the some of the training sessions that I've given them. I thought, like, I mean, I wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, not because it's hard, because it's monotonous. And
Yeah, I was
but you
gonna
talk to them, and
say,
like, they're like, coach, what do we need to do
yeah, that's
to get better? And I think there's a lesson in that. I think one of the things that attracts me to running is the fact that it, like, ultimately, at its core, is like a blue collar sport, right? And it's a sport where success has been achieved throughout history, but typically the have-nots. And I think that's
wow.
a lot of the beauty lies in that, right? And it's a fascinating, it's like sort of dichotomy in Cape Town, in that you have like the southern suburbs, which is such a hub for trail running, but ultimately it's also like where a lot of the haves live. And I come from the southern suburbs, so I can say that. But you know, always joke. And if you had to take like five kids from southern suburb school, and you had to take five kids from the townships just randomly, and you had to put them on the track and they run a mile, like, I'd be very surprised if the five kids from the communities, whatever, aren't the first five kids across the line.
Yeah.
And so ultimately, we have a role and a job to grow the opportunity sets. Now I'm talking about not only for like mass participation, but at the highest level of the sports,
Yeah.
is that we have so much talent in South Africa. It
Yes.
is,
Yes.
and we can make this argument for track and road, and lots of really
Yeah.
good coaches and people do.
Yeah.
But if you combine natural physiology, what did Fordyce always say? The best training you could ever do is select your parents. If you combine natural physiology with a willingness and determination to get yourself out of a difficult situation,
Yeah,
life,
yeah.
get away from gangs, all these kind of things, right? Ultimately, it's very difficult to manufacture that determination to succeed
Yeah,
if you don't have
yeah.
it,
If you don't have it.
if it's not been driven by your environment.
Yeah. I think the lesson I learned from that is like, do you run for the right reason? Or like, can you run when it's actually hard? And I'm not talking about like hard as in like, oh, it's raining and my rain jacket's maybe not going to do the job or the wind's blowing. It's like when it's not beautiful, when you're doing the same stair repeats in Bolito to try and simulate something that you're going to do in the mountains, and versus, you know, the humans who the haves, like they've got a lot and whatever other life stress. I know we when we talk about recovery and all these things and we talk about life stress, and I'm like, so relative as well. Like there's a big difference between like, oh, I was stressed because, you know, I finished my run and then I didn't get my kawaii smoothie in the 30-minute window, versus like, am I gonna have food on the table like for the rest of the week? And despite all of that, the talent that comes through and people like Lindy and you partnering with the team at Live to Run, I just, yeah, I'm stoked to see what they're gonna do, and the passion and everything that you see there makes me excited about the future of the sport. Really, really cool.
No, I completely agree, and I think it's a very valuable perspective to have, and it's actually been it's been a fascinating journey for me, having had that involvement with Love and other development athletes, combined with like I guess like the majority of your client base and where they sit, from an income standpoint, and sometimes the challenges of like seeing what the Love guys or development guys are going through, like what pressure actually is, like putting food on your table, getting a roof over your head. And then ultimately, like, you know, you can't judge these things, but like on the same day, you might get a complaint about the weather or something, you know what I mean? And you sit in the middle and you're like, whoa, okay, I need to be like empathetic to both sides here.
Oh,
But it's
anyway.
hard because you're seeing one thing, like, and it's quite powerful.
Yeah, I think being sensitive to people's context, that's like a skill that a coach, like an unspoken skill, that coaches need to have, which is what I'm going to ask you more about now. What skills do we need? So, James, between, I mean, we've touched on like a couple of things of like the developing coach and where you started and where you are now, and you've got a range of experience. I think that's what's pulling through as well. And I checked on the on your guys' website, between you and Meg, you guys have coached over 1,000 athletes across like different continents. That is a lot of people. I know you made a comment about like getting to 100 people, and then I actually thought about 1,000, and I was like, if you put 1,000 people in a room or a state part a field, it's like, dang, that's a lot of people. And like the coach athlete relationship is not a it's not a passing like client touch point thing. It's like it's much deeper than that. So I was like, 1,000 is a lot. But I mean, what is your most, I said most recent because it's impossible to say, I think, the most significant one, but what has been a significant lesson learned in like working with a range of like athletes and 1,000 people, different context spaces and different levels of the sport? What do you, as a coach, what do you feel like you've learned?
So I think a general thing that I've learned, and I actually learned this from Mike Watson before I learned from necessarily coaching, but it was reinforced by coaching, is to learn to sit on the fence and to pick and choose tools based on the contexts in front of you. And I think too often we kind of spoke about before we started recording, how easy it is to sort of read a book or coach one person, particularly yourself, have some level of success, and then extrapolate that and believe that that is going to be how everyone is going to have improve or see improvements, right? And so I think too often, if I look back, being too dogmatic on an approach has very seldom worked. And it's quite funny because if I look at some of the people that I've coached since the beginning, and actually quite a few, you have to ask them how much things have changed. They'll tell you a lot. And I think what I've learned is to be less dogmatic, less stuck on any one particular thing, and almost trying to view every situation as a blank canvas. And it's funny because it's a very similar journey to what I went on in finance. And so I'm now
Interesting.
almost aware of like, is that like, when does that become a bias again? Do you know what I
Yeah.
mean? So like, when does that your natural pathway or the pathway of least resistance? But I've been asked before, like, what are the like, they seem like such different things, like coaching, running, and finance. And I'm like, that actually, to me, they ended up being quite similar, because I was always interested in, well, I became more interested in behavioral finance as time went on. So I guess I studied in like a very traditional route of business science, UCT, and then did CFA, and all these very analytical, you're given a whole lot of analytical tools to forecast financial statements, to project earnings numbers, all these things, right? And what I often found was that people that had held on to what they studied became very one-dimensional in the way they thought about things. And actually, if you have that background and understanding, but are able to overlay that with an understanding of behavior, like in finance, greed is a massive one, and fear are the two, right? If you look at the world
Yeah,
class,
wow.
like greed and fear. And actually, running in some ways is quite similar. It's very much driven by athletes that are often very insecure. And that's not
Yeah.
a bad thing. That insecurity drives them to train really hard. So there's an element of fear, and there's
Yeah.
an element of greed when things start to go well. So they want more, they
Yes.
want more fitness, they want to train harder. And so actually, some ways to be able to have that like understanding and appreciation for behavioral biases actually very similar. And I'm sure if you had to look at a number of different sectors and industries or jobs, that would be quite similar. It's like, if you have that skill sets, you can apply a lot of those same learnings from finance into running.
Super interesting. Yeah, the parallels that are there. And I'm like, oh, I keep wanting to jump like to the athletes section, but for now I want to stick on the coaching side and things that you've been learning. And I mean, you mentioned now be less dogmatic, and I don't know, maybe this is the same question, but if you could, with starting with coaching and figuring it out, and there's like all this change that happened, if you could go back to Monty the day before he quit his job for the first time and give yourself one piece of advice before this thing, like you jumped in and it boomed, what do you think that would be?
It'll probably be, probably a very similar piece of advice. It's a very classic thing. It's the Dunning-Kruger effect. It's like, you have a little bit of knowledge and you extrapolate it and you believe that it's applicable in a far more wider spectrum than is actually the case. And I think too often, you kind of mentioned you sort of kick any bush in Cape Town and a running coach falls out. And I've been known to be quite critical of that. And the reason for that is that, like, ultimately, even if you figure yourself out, that's a very small part of the journey of figuring other people out.
Yeah. Wow.
And I think too often people that are good runners think they're good runners because they understand coaching, and underestimate the fact that they're actually good runners because they've been given a gift to run fast, irrespective of what they've done in training. And so I almost think the advantage that I've had is that it actually has been very difficult to get the most out of myself, because I don't have natural t like n I was a good sports person with ball sports, but
Yeah.
actually running is not one of those. And I think, like, part of like the reason that I stuck with it is because it's actually been so difficult. It's
Yeah.
required so much figuring out.
Yeah.
And then, you slowly figure out yourself, and then, each person after that teaches you another lesson.
Yeah.
And so I really do think one needs to be very careful about reading a book or reading multiple books or understanding training yourself and then trying to extrapolate that. It's almost the point where two of my favorite people in Cape Town are Mike and Robin Owen, and I remember them giving me the analogy of when they lived in Chamonix about understanding mountaineering, and they're like, they only got to a point towards the end of their time here where they understood the risks that they were actually taking.
Well,
And those are two people who are really skilled in the mountain.
yeah,
And I think
experienced.
it's very similar in coaching. I feel more insecure and I have more concerns about what I don't know now with a number of years of coaching than I did 8 years ago or 7 years ago or 9 years ago, 10 years ago.
Yes.
And I think that's an important balance to try and strike. Like for
Yeah.
me, sitting and talking to, and there are people that I engage with where I sit there and I'm like, I have that like almost like a little bit of an anxious feeling in my chest where I think like, whoa, this person knows so much more than I do. I have so much that I've got to learn
Yeah.
still,
Yeah.
you know? And I think too many people don't have that.
Yeah, it's almost like you lose a respect for what you don't know. It's like, oh, I know just enough and I've seen enough success to extrapolate this to loads of people. Even if it's not necessarily copy and paste, you can't take like these principles of success and this recipe worked here and they're going to work there. It's not, yeah. And I think if you lose that and you stop asking questions or reading different things, like not just coaching stuff, like you've just mentioned, you know, what you've learned from the financial world can be applied here. And I think keeping your eyes and ears open to different things that can influence it, but never treading that line, like you said, the balance of having the confidence, like I can be here, I can give advice, athletes can trust me with their journey. But in the other hand of that is I'm doing my best to keep learning, to keep asking the right questions and never have a I've reached it moment, you know, I've arrived. I think that's that tension that you have to. Yeah, because I think we've all had a hiding when you think you've arrived and then something just goes south and you're like, oh, okay, no, back to the drawing board. Yeah.
I think it's very hard. It would be very difficult for me to ever become overconfident in coaching because that's the success in inverted commas that you may have with one athlete one weekend is offset by the disappointment from another.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you a single big European racing weekend where I've come away thinking like, I know the answers.
Yes.
Everyone I come
Yes.
away thinking, scratching my head,
Yeah.
how can we be better?
Yeah.
And I think that's why it's a fulfilling career.
Yeah. You keep coming
And
back. There's still things to figure out. And actually, a good example for me, James, is I remember seeing, I think, a photograph of you with we had an incredible team at Trail Running World Champs last year. And I know there was like, was it the night before? There was like crazy course changes. So for those who don't know, it's like South Africa's got loads of talent. And then it was like some of the best go. And there was a range of like different distances and events. So you had like your VK. Was there something shorter than the marathon? I can't
there's a
remember.
mountain classic, yeah. So
Yeah.
there's World Mountain Running, which is actually it's an uphill race, which is technically like similar to a VK, but normally a little bit more runnable and not necessarily 1,000 meters.
Yeah.
And then what they call the Mountain Classic, which is like a 16K race, not technical at all. And in fact, the route that they used through Innsbruck did have a fair amount of road in it, not normally, but a significant amount of climbing, and then obviously the marathon and the ultra.
Yeah. And that ultra, I remember seeing the course change and going flip. I mean, I had people I knew who were running, and I was just like the distance and the vert, it changed the whole game at the very last minute. And anyway, it's like you have South Africans are on this stage and I think they're too, you've got a shot and you want to measure yourself, like, you know, one against the like your global competition and two against the course. It's like where we train and where I think some of our athletes race is really different. But you were quite involved there. And I think again, mixed bag, there were some incredible results. I think, well, for us watching at home, we just back the girls and boys in green. We just like, yes, everything's incredible. They made it. But yeah, chat to us a bit about like the range of experiences that you had there. I mean, things that come people that come to mind, I think Kane, Johart, Bianca. Yeah, chat to us about that.
Yeah, so I think already by that point in, let's say, my coaching career, the expectations that I had were well grounded, insofar as I've coached enough athletes racing in Europe to know the level of competition, the difficulty of being able to train for those races in South Africa and come over and compete, and just the depth and breadth of those fields. So I think, you come away from those experiences and you certainly do feel like you want to scratch your head, because some athletes make it look very simple. And often, the coach in you wants to think comes down to coaching and or access to better terrain. But sometimes it's just like you just have to accept, like, physiology plays such a massive part in running, right? It's like, in some ways, it's like the ultimate tests of human physiology. Like, you're not riding a bicycle, you're not paddling a boat. You know what I mean? Ultimately, like, it's kind of you and your 2 feet. And obviously, with trail running, there's a skill component. But yeah, so for me, it was an incredible experience. And to see the efforts that all of those athletes put in was probably the highlight of certainly my coaching career, and definitely one of the highlights of my life. To see what it means to sort of compete for your country versus just yourself. And I think that is the magic of world trail and mountain running relative to the UTMB or Golden Trail Series, where there's very similar athletes, right? But that element of competing for your country is hard to put your finger on. And it is difficult. It's difficult to fly out. I think the guys got there on the Monday, and then you're racing. I think the races were Tuesday through Saturday. So even the guys who did the ultra, they raced on the Friday, if I'm not mistaken. They had a 20-odd hour flight. They got there. It's hard, right? But also, what's quite fascinating is that Meg went to Broken Arrow earlier this year, and the guy who won both the uphill classic, the uphill race, and the classic on the Sunday, he got in, flew from Kenya to Amsterdam to Reno, and he got there on the same day as Meg was, which was like the Wednesday or the Thursday. And then literally the Friday he won the uphill, and the Sunday he won the classic. And like, it can be done. So we also have to be careful of like setting a narrative that then becomes your truth.
Yeah, like if I don't get out an earlier flight, this automatically is going to tank my events. It's like not necessarily, but just keeping it in mind. Yeah, that balance.
But I think the trajectory of that event is very exciting. And I think what makes me so passionate about it is not only the trail running side, but it's actually the mountain running side. Because mountain running is, you can imagine, almost the middle ground between road and track and trail. So a lot of vert. So within a 16K race, I think there was 750 or 800 meters of climbing, but it's not technical. And so the barriers to entry are lower. And so one of the reasons that I wanted to get involved in the first place was because I'd love for track and road coaches in South Africa with access to talented youth to be able to see that this is another avenue from which they can create a career. The Kenyans base themselves in Austria for the whole summer, European summer, and they go race. I mean, you saw Sears Knoll this year.
Yeah, unreal.
And it's, we have those talented athletes. And, actually, as a team, that was our highest placing, was in the men's mountain classic. And of those guys, Siboniso and Sipho had raced trail before, but both were predominantly road track, Siboniso, steeplechase. So
So
these guys
cool.
stepped into a race with minimal experience, probably not really even knowing what mountain running was themselves. And I think we were 16th overall, which is remarkable. And so give those coaches a little more experience for what they're in for. And I think it's a wonderful opportunity set for development athletes to create another pathway, another opportunity, another platform from which they can succeed outside of the track and outside of road. So that's kind of, yeah. But I think if I have to look at probably the highlight of that event was the Saturday was the men's and women's mountain classic. So it's 16K, and I was walking to the race, and I was walking with Kane, Llewellyn, and Ewart. And obviously all three have sort of come up through very traditional athletics backgrounds. And I can only sort of compare it to walking to a Springbok game with your mates, and like the excitement that all of us were feeling. Llewellyn was about to race, so maybe less so for him, but for the rest of us, certainly just that, like the excitement of going to watch,
The
like
anticipation of
compete.
what's about to happen.
And then two of the South African guys basically leading. We were standing at about 100 meters on this road section through the middle of Innsbruck, and two of the South African guys like leading, and it was like it was spine tingling. I mean, you knew there was a really good chance they were going to go out the back door at some point, but the fact that they took it on is
They're in
what
the mix.
they're in the mix, and they're there to race and to win. And I think that's amazing. If I could
That
take one moment from that championship, that would be it.
that's so cool. I love that pride that we feel. I think now we've just all come out of the Olympics and you're seeing just incredible content, and I'm all for the South Africans. And I don't know exactly when this episode's going to be released. I might put a short out, but I mean, you're going to feel this as well in just a week's time, where it's like this time next week, the OCC is going to be kind of going down. We've got a couple
Oh,
of great
CCC on Friday, OCC on
CCC,
Thursday.
sorry, OCC on Thursday. So that would already be done. CCC on Friday, that 100K, that, oh, it's exciting. And there's a couple of South Africans in just down the road from you and Sham. It's so great to see, like, more than a handful, I want to say, are there, whether it's supporting or racing. And so, I'm stoked for you. And I hope, I don't want to get too much into if your athletes already and this and that. Everyone's just got such a different journey. But are you feeling a similar sense of like anticipation and excitement to watch them all race?
Yeah, I think it's going into these races again, one always has to be very careful about your own emotions and the energy that you're putting out for the athletes that you work with, right? And I think for me, it's always a time to reflect with them actually about how proud they can be of the work and the effort that they've put in before it all kicks off, because it's very easy to lose sight of all of that when you're in it, or after the fact, even if it goes well or it goes badly. And I think I'm lucky enough to work with a number of athletes that are competing at a high level, but actually running is a very small part of their lives. And I think that is the thing
Interesting.
that I find most inspiring, and something that I guess look up to in a way. I think about someone like, Daniel and Kane are two examples of guys that are here. Obviously, both have very busy jobs, both have wives. Kane obviously has a kid, and running is the least important for them out of all those things, and it should be. And yet, when they're out running, they're giving their best and they're putting in what they can when they can. They are by no means professional athletes in how we think about that. And I admire that. And yet they come to the biggest races against the most competitive fields, and they lay their egos on the line. And I think that's, for me, is incredible, or incredibly valuable and inspiring, because that's what it's all about, right? It's not about when everything's lined up perfectly and
And it's all
you can
gone
have
well, and
seven massages a day, I mean, a week, and an afternoon nap, and all these things is like these guys are fitting in training and making sacrifices to do what they need to do, while still having their partners, their families, their jobs at the top of their priority lists. And I think that's inspiring.
I think for the, I feel like I've known this for a while, but it's kind of, there's been one or two moments this year where I've felt it or seen it firsthand. And it's the pressure that the athletes are under, especially as trail running grows and they step onto the global stage, something like UTMB, that is all eyes on you. And even people who don't necessarily know loads about trail running will probably know about that. And it's like to line up there, as you said, you lay your ego on the line, but just that pressure, again, you're representing, you're there. South Africa, that's who you're representing. You've got loads of people back home, as you mentioned, all the sacrifice. So I think I'm just like hats off to each and every one of them already, like before the race starts, no matter what goes down, like to put yourself out there and just absolutely go for it. I'm like, most people will never do something that brave in their whole life. And they
Yeah,
will not
100%.
only do it once, they will line up and do it again. Regardless of the outcome, knowing all those personalities, everyone who's popping into my mind now, I'm like, whether it goes well or not, they'll do it again. And they love the sport and they can, they what they carry, I'm just like absolute legends.
No, they are. I think kind of first and foremost, good people. And I think what's helped those two in particular, and I think similarly to Yart, Llewellyn as well, is also having been brought up through that sort of athletics background, where they are very well aware of what the very best in sport looks like. And
For sure.
so they want to get the most out of themselves. But equally, if you had to sit each one of them down and say, like, on your best day, where are you relative to the very best in the world? They know, because they've seen it, they know what someone who's able to run a 27-minute 10K looks like.
There's a
You are
humility there.
yeah, there's a humility. You are grew up training with Elroy, like one of South Africa's best ever distance runners. He's under no illusions as to what it is, what it takes to be the best. And I think that's important. I think it's one of the issues with trail running, and I guess particularly in countries that are still fairly small, in terms of like maybe not even like the top level athletes, but the breadth and depth of those fields, is that I think you almost get lulled into a false sense of ability. And it's natural, right? You go to a race and you come in the top 10, you're like, wow, we're getting the top 10. But you must remember, even in a local French race, there's probably 150 people that would come in the top 10 of a South African race. And it's good to keep that in mind. And we'll get there as a country. The sport will grow and we'll continue to get more and more talented people. But it does, I think, in some ways, like sets people up for disappointment when they come here.
Yeah, and you want to
Because now all
manage
of a
that.
sudden, And as a coach, unfortunately, part of what you have to do is help them get a little bit of a reality check before they get here, because you line up at a race like CSNL or ACC or CCC or whatever, there's a very strong likelihood that at halfway you're significantly further down the field than you had hoped, and you have to be okay with that, and you have to learn to still want to get the most out of yourself. And that's hard.
That
It's
is
hard.
hard. And it's like to, I think as the coach, I can imagine if say you were out on the course to still find that line of like, I know that you're further down in the field than you'd hope to be, but this is still an excellent performance for you today, like, or you're still getting something out of yourself now that say 2, 3 years ago, you would never have dreamed. It's just that like perspective, like what lens are you viewing this result through? And knowing these
100%.
athletes, despite the humility that I think that critical thing, they want the best out of themselves. They want to run well for their country. And sometimes I think the critical voice can outweigh the kind of affirming voice. And again, role of a coach, how can you just guide them on that line, like that tightrope, just like see it for what it is, and worry less about the position, but this is the small victories that came out of it.
And I think a mistake I've made is that that preparation work needs to happen long before the race ever starts, because by the time you see them at a crewing station, it's too late. Like
Oh,
the negative thoughts have significantly outweighed the positive ones,
yeah,
and you're
that
not gonna,
narrative's
you,
winning.
it's very, yeah, it's very unlikely that you're going to turn things around then. That's why I got to give someone like Bianca huge amounts of credit. Like, she's had a few occasions where things haven't gone her way, and she's now learned that you have to put in the work long before the race starts.
Yes.
The training is one thing, but understanding your mind, understanding your motivation, understanding your drivers,
Yeah.
and that's something that's very different when you are competing to finish a race versus competing to succeed in a race and succeed, as a professional athlete and,
Yeah.
justify your contract and all those kind of things.
Yeah.
It's tough, and I think we spoke about like reading books and things a little bit earlier, like and like what areas you now focus your attention on. For me now, I don't spend very much time reading about running, but I spend a lot of time reading about psychology
Yeah.
because I can see that's an area where you can assist an athlete greatly, and it's for me a significantly bigger untapped area of knowledge than another running book.
Yeah. Amazing. I'm gonna ask you more about what you read just now. And I think, Monty, something that as we transition into this, it's like we've spoken about like the coaching thing. Now we've chatted about a couple of the athletes. And one of the print things when I initially reached out to you, I was like, I know that this is something I want to chat to you about. And that's this concept of like the evolving athlete. So like even what you mentioned now with like B and for those who don't know her well, go and listen to her episode. It's not just mine. She's done a couple of podcasts. She's an amazing person to listen to in an interview, and just her how she views things is next level. But I think so continuity in training is huge. That's like a big kind of principle that it's not sexy, it's not glamorous. It's just like waking up every day, putting in the work, and then there is an element of like you'll get out what you put in. And then for me, what I wanted to bring in with you was I think there is a merit to working with the same coach, or having continuity and this like sustained relationship with the same person who, as long as they're able to grow and change along or like with you, because I think this thing of the evolving athlete. So as you've grown and changed, and then even your athletes who've come in, you start working with them, you have this blank canvas, like you've mentioned, and then you get maybe they, and not everyone, this is not just for the top level athletes, but who they are a year, 2 years, 3 years down the line is not the blank canvas that you started with. So how's that? How do you view that whole process? Like, where do you help step in and shape and like be like, okay, we're bringing you back to, this is the goal, or where do you kind of allow the big scary dreams almost to kind of lead someone? Like that's a tough thing as well as a coach, like how to advise to keep the dream alive, but also be like, the reality of this is like, this is your kind of ceiling.
It is. It's very tricky. And I think it's actually interesting. I mean, I've coached Bianca for a good number of years, so she's actually a good example of that, where like at the beginning, very much a case of someone who didn't know a lot about the sports, I guess the relationship is one of like very much a teacher and a student. And as she's evolved as an athlete and as a person, she's got more and more knowledge about herself and maybe the direction she wants to go and training ideas and things like that. And it can be difficult because you do have to evolve. And I think it's being open to listening, being open to making mistakes. And I certainly think like even with her, I've made mistakes in being too far behind at times her evolving as a person, not necessarily as an athlete. I guess because you see them all the time as an athlete, it's a bit easier. But I guess like allowing people to make mistakes, you don't always have to be right. And I
Yeah,
think
wow.
that's, yeah, it's not an easy journey, and it's definitely not something I'm perfect at. But I think it's sometimes it's easier, like when I started working with Meg. which was only a year ago, you're ready at that point. You're like, no, Meg knows a lot about her body. So it starts out as more of a partnership, probably the same as Kane, the same as you are. It starts out as more of a partnership. But when that relationship changes from like starts out more student teacher and then evolves into being more of a partnership. And even in this last build up to Sierra Zinal now, I'd say like Bianca and my coaching relationship was far more like a partnership than it's probably ever been. Because that's what we felt we needed. And maybe in hindsight, that should have been from the start of the year already. But you make mistakes and you learn, and I guess you've got to give each other the space to make those mistakes and to be able to communicate openly about them. Sometimes as coaching relationships, you have to have hard conversations, and you have to have a thick enough skin to be able to realize when you've made mistakes. And yeah, I think if there's one thing I've made a lot of is mistakes, and it's never been about not making mistakes. It's always been about making lots of mistakes, but trying to catch them quickly
Yes, and
and
learn
make
from them.
changes.
Something I picked up from the Run Project website, classic stalking everybody before I do these interviews, was that you mentioned the word fun more than once. So it was really cool for me to read like coaching philosophy, a bit of the info, but that's just kind of something that popped out at me. And I think you work with a range of people from like kind of couch to marathon and then some of the best of the best. So that's an interesting thing for me. Like, how do you keep the principle of fun and running in the training process with all of your athletes?
So I think running can be a beautifully creative outlet for people. And I think one of the data and I guess the tools that we have sort of at our disposal now as coaches and athletes can be incredibly insightful. But ultimately, I really believe that you should be able to coach someone with very little data. And as an athlete, you should be able to train with very little data. And the reason I say that is because ultimately, like all the data that we could ever need as an athlete is in our bodies, right? So our bodies are telling us everything we need to know at all points in time. And if you go back in history, I mean, even if you go back to the 1960s and you look at the times that let's say Arthur Lydiard's, like someone like Peter Snell was running in the 800 meter, like those times were still competitive today, right? And you think about how little technology they had access to then relative to now. And of course, you could go to different distances and say, like, okay, well, there's been huge improvements in the marathon and this. But one might argue that, like, almost like the an 800 meter I guess one of those distances that. And even the 1500, where you can where it's so heavily reliant on like athleticism, and it's quite simple. Do you know what I mean? It's like there's not that much in terms of like having to understand, I guess, nutrition and the aspects, the variables that we can kind of take out of that simplify those events. And I think Herb Elliott's another one, like probably one of the greatest, or one of the three greatest 1500 meter and milers of all time, right? And he was coached by Percy Cerruti. And I think, like, when you kind of read what these guys did, there was always an element of like fun to what they did. Like, Percy Cerruti is renowned for like the guys wrestling on the beach and doing sand dune sprints. And obviously, Lydiard, maybe a little bit less fun, but you know, they did hill bounding phases. And I always just think like there's such a creativity to what they did, right? And it kind of gets to hopefully one of the questions that you sent through to me that hopefully we'll get to, is kind of like what is a great, or what makes a great coach? And I think part of that is creativity. It's problem solving and creativity. And
There you have it, folks. Part one of Monty's two-part episode. I hope that you all enjoyed this. Please tune in next week for part two, where we continue to talk about how to work with athletes who are evolving, changing, what constitutes a good coach, and what are some of the more specific things that really go into understanding an athlete and planning their training and racing accordingly. I will see you back here all next week for our next episode.